Imagine Granny from Tweety and Sylvester, Rocky J. Squirrel, Natasha Fatale, Cindy Lou Who, Ursula from George of the Jungle, and Witch Hazel. You can immediately identify with these crazy cartoon characters just by hearing their characteristic voices. These would all be attributed to just one voice. June Foray, next.
I like the fruit flavor of tricks. I like the fruit flavor of tricks. I like the fruit flavor of tricks.
But tricks are meant for kids. Yes, sir. Tricks are for you. It's the corn cereal with fruit flavor goodness.
Fruit colors, too.
So try tricks.
Does your shoe have a boy inside? What a funny place for a boy to hide.
Does your shoe have a dog there too?
A boy and a dog and a foot in a shoe. Well, the boy is Buster Brown.
And the dog is Tige, his friend.
And they're really just a picture. But it's fun to play pretend.
So if boys and girls like you want some fun, get the shoe.
With a picture of the boy and the dog inside, so you can put your foot into Buster Brown's shoes.
Thanks for joining me today on another Boing podcast, where I highlight the careers of animators, cartoonists, illustrators, and all creative talent there within, with a concentration, of course, on anthropomorphic cartoons, that, of course, being of the fuzzy and furry kind. Glad to have you on this fine, fun-filled afternoon or morning or evening, depending on when you are listening. I'm Tom Dolce, your host, and I'm excited, really, really excited today about my guest that I have on, and the exciting part is the fact that I grew up listening to her voice behind the cartoon Squirrel that I watched so closely on our family's Admiral TV set back in the 60s. Now that I'm dating myself, the squirrel I'm referring to, of course, is Rocky J. Squirrel, and the show, of course, being Rocky and Bullwinkle. The voice? Well, none other than that of June Foray, and yes, she's here to talk about her amazing career as a voice actress, which is still, I repeat, still going on today. So coming up next will be the interview with June Foray, the voice actress extraordinaire, who her career is just so deep-rooted that it's incredible the voices that she portrayed. It's just incredible, the jobs that she has had in her career, throughout her career, that dates back to when she was just 12 years old in Springfield, Massachusetts. And that's where I pick up with the interview with June Foray. Out at a local radio drama in Springfield, Massachusetts.
That's correct. I was 12 years old.
And by the age of 15, you were doing regular radio work. And what I would love to do is to see if you could share with us how this started and exactly what, I guess, sparked the interest in doing this in the first place and when you discovered your voice.
Oh, well, my mother and father were very intellectual people, and they were omnivorous readers, as I got to be. And they would take us to the movies, and we'd listen to operas on radio, and they'd take us to stage plays. And when I was about 5 or 6, they were still taking us to the theater, and I saw Eva LaGallion. She was a very famous actress at that time. And I came home and I said to my mother and dad, you know, I really want to be an actress. And they kind of laughed at me, you know. Here I am, a little bitty kid, but I would impersonate everybody. And so my mother was a singer and a pianist. And so I guess she was a little accustomed to show business. But Eleanor Powell came from Springfield, Massachusetts, and she became a big dancing star and then just became a star in Hollywood. And so my mother thought, oh, well, maybe I better give her dancing lessons first. Well, I was fortunate enough to get pneumonia, and, and so I didn't dance anymore. And then she was a pianist, and so my brother could sit at the piano and just pick up and play anything, and but she thought I should take piano lessons to be well bred and intellectual. Right. And I said, and you know, I didn't care. And she'd be yelling from the kitchen, she'd yell flat, sharp, you know. I didn't care. And finally I broke my finger playing baseball with my brother. And so I said, you know, I really want to be an actress. So my mother and dad got me a wonderful, they called them elocution teachers at the time. Okay. And so the first one she got me, I didn't like, because she would make me read poems by Edward Guest, you know, often nannies come to our house to stay. And I was reading more adult literature at that time. So my mother got another teacher for me, Mrs. Larson, and she was quite intellectual. And so I was reading at the time. I read Shakespeare and all the old Elizabethan plays, which I loved. Right. And she had a radio show, and she put me on a show when I was 12. And then I heard a group, they were on every week doing a different show, sometimes an original play, and sometimes a literature. And so I had the hubris to call them and say, you know, I can do parts like that. They hired me. I think I got $5, something like that.
Wow, yeah.
And so that's what started. And then when my mother and dad moved to California with my brother and my sister and me, I started writing. And I wrote children's stories. I called myself Lady Make-Believe. And I was on 3 times a week. On different radio stations out here. And they were very successful, and they went through the schools. The schools just loved the stories that I wrote. So in the morning, they had them broadcast in the auditoriums. Isn't that something?
That's fascinating. That's, oh my God.
And I was only, you know, I was only 19, 20, something like that. So I was very fortunate. And we had the earthquake in 1994, I think it was. And I went out to my garage, and there were boxes there with scripts falling out. And my husband was a screenwriter, Hobart Donovan. And so I thought they were his scripts. They were my Lady Make-Believe scripts, and I read them. And this was just, 15 years ago?
Wow.
And they were so good, I recorded 6, and I sent them, and Ted Turner bought them for $10,000.
And that's, what a story that is. That's great.
Isn't that something?
That's amazing.
But then Turner was bought by Warners, and then AOL bought Warners, so they weren't anything that Turner wanted to do. They didn't. So I called Atlanta and I said, could I have my stories back? And they said, well, you'll have to return the $10,000. And I said, well, I've already paid taxes on it and it's gone. And they said, well, you're going to have to wait until the 3 years are up for the option. So I did, and I got them back.
Oh,
and I think I'm going to put them on CDs and sell them.
I would, definitely. So now in the mid, I guess it was, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I'm thinking it's the mid to late 30s when you were in L.A. You moved to L.A. and then you find yourself.
That's correct.
Right, so you were doing voice acting and radio, but I also heard that you were with Jimmy Durante and Danny Thomas and
yes,
Phil
Harris. I did Lux Radio Theater. I did Screen Directors Playhouse, and I did a show when I first met my husband, the Smile Ned McConnell show. It was my husband wrote it and directed it. It started out in Chicago. I had never heard of him or Ed McConnell, and so they came out here, and my husband called Radio Actors Television. I don't know. They called it RATE. It was actually a telephone service.
Okay.
And so my husband called and said, I need somebody who can do different voices. And they said, oh, well, you better call June Foray. And that's how I first met my husband, when he hired me for the radio show, Smile and Ed McConnell, it was called.
Wow, that's great. That's a great story. Did you ever stop and just kind of like pinch yourself, and could you believe it was happening, or did you just keep on moving forward, job after job?
No, it never entered my mind.
Yeah.
And then at CBS at that time, people would be in the lobby at CBS, and they were wonderful. They had chairs and sofas so actors could sit there and chat, and then grab a hold of a producer if they came in and say, hey, look, I can do that.
Oh,
and so,
that's funny.
Yeah, so yeah. One young lady said, you know, there are a couple of guys who just came up from Arizona, and they're looking for somebody who can do a lot of different voices. She said, I'm just an ingenue, I can't do it. So she said, why don't you call them, which I did, and did an audition, and they hired me. And it was Steve Allen.
Oh, my
Steve
gosh.
Allen with Wendell Noble. And so I did all kinds of crazy voices. Steve wrote them, and he would sit at the piano, and the other actor would sing. And we'd do these crazy skits that he would write. And we did it every morning. I got $25 a show.
Oh, my gosh.
Every morning. It was not sponsored. But anyway, I've known Steve all of these years. And when I got my star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, he was my head speaker there.
Oh, that's neat. That's neat. Now, you also did some film acting as well in front of the camera. Now, I also read somewhere where they were saying that because of your smaller frame, it kind of worked against you.
Okay. The last thing I did on camera, I turned down a lot of on-camera things because I was doing radio and making money, and I didn't want to work 5 days a week behind the camera. You know, I mean, on camera, and okay. Wait until my part. No, the last thing I did was Green Acres. I played a Mexican girl on that.
Right. Yeah, that's neat. Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that, because I was reading that, and I thought, I'm going to ask her that when I get a chance.
Well, that's pure lie, yeah. Because I turned down a lot of things. Because, you know, in radio, you work from morning until night when we first started, because they didn't have transcriptions at the time or tape. And so we'd do a show 5 o'clock here for the East Coast, and then come back at 8 o'clock at night and do the show out here. So, you know, I didn't want to be bothered. I turned down Fraser. I turned down a lot of shows. Yep. I didn't want to do it.
Yep. I don't blame you. You had a good thing going. Now, you
and
also...
I could make a lot of money. You know, I can go in my slacks and work for 2 hours and make $2,000 or $1,500 or whatever.
Right. Exactly. Now, in the 40s, you also did a lot of work, it looks like, with Stan Freberg, Dawes Butler, and Pinto Colvig for Capitol Records.
Yes, we were put under contract to Capitol.
Did you enjoy that assignment?
Oh, it was wonderful. We were hired to do children's stories first. Alan Livingston was the A&R man there, okay. Artist in repertoire. And Alan would take some of the Disney films because they didn't have their record companies at the time. They'd take things from Warner's and Disney and translate them into transcriptions for kids.
Right.
Wow. Records.
Yep.
And then Freberg and Dawes came up with St. George and the Dragonette and Little Blue Riding Hood, and then Stan wrote the USA, and so I was in all of those as well. And that was with Capitol, but we did about 40 shows.
Wow.
Or records at Capitol.
That's a lot. Now, did you find that helped you get to, then I guess from there, is that when you started to get into more of the cartooning and into like Warner Brothers or?
Yes, because as I said, Disney and Warner didn't have record companies at the time. And so Disney, I guess, heard me do all the cockeyed voices on Smile Time with Steve Allen and all of the records that we did of their pictures. And so they called me. The first thing I ever did was The Cat and Cinderella. He didn't have any dialogue, but I was working for Disney, and that was enough for me. And so so they... I did a lot of things at Disney, starting with Witch Hazel and Peter Pan, and they rotoscoped me for one of the mermaids in Peter Pan because I was very pretty and nice figure. And then Warner Brothers, they loved Witch Hazel that I did, and my agent called one day and said, how would you like to work at Warner Brothers at a cartoon? And I said, I love it. And they said, and you're going to meet the famous Chuck Jones. And I said, Chuck who? I didn't know who Chuck Jones was. You know, I was doing radio. I really didn't know much about animation, except when I was working at Disney. And then it just took off. And that's what I did for practically the rest of my life. And I'm still doing it.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Now, here's another thing I heard, and this is your chance to either tell me it's bunk or it's true. There's some stories going around too that during your time with Warner Brothers, that there was a contract with Mel Blanc that he got exclusive voice credit for all the shows.
Yes, he did.
Therefore, you did not really get a lot of credit there.
Nobody got credit, just Mel.
Wow, what a deal that was.
Yeah. I didn't mind. It was work, and I was making money. And I was working in animation. So it didn't bother me. And people, now they recognize my voice, and they know I did it.
Right, right, exactly.
So
exactly.
It doesn't bother me. I know it did bother Stan, but it didn't bother me at all.
Now, I'm a huge fan of Rocky and Bullwinkle. And
I know.
How did that start at that point? I guess, did it come after Warner Brothers? How did that begin? How did you end up getting involved with that job?
Well, it was, I didn't pursue it. I had never heard of the show he did up in San Francisco. I got a call from a secretary, and she said, there's a Mr. Jay Ward. He has an idea for a show, and he'd like to take you to lunch. So, you know, free lunch, why not? So,
yeah.
And I wasn't working that day. So I went to the Tail of the Cock, which is a wonderful restaurant on La Cienega here. It's no longer there. And I met Jay Ward, and he had a man with him called Bill Scott. Right. And they were drinking martinis, and they said, have a martini. And I said, I'm sorry, I don't drink at noon, you know. And they said, oh, come on, we're having one. So I said, okay. And so they started talking to me about a moose and a squirrel, with, you know, who talked to regular people. They were like people, not animals. And I thought it was a cockeyed idea, but after the second martini, I thought it was a hell of an idea. So we did a demo for the following week, and he told me that he wanted Rocky to be an All-American boy and Natasha, not Russian because she's from Pennsylvania. And so we did the demo, and a whole year went by, and I forgot about it because I was working hard anyway. And all of a sudden, I got a call, and they said, we're ready to go. And that's what started it.
Wow, what a story.
That was in 59. We were with NBC, ABC from 59 to 61 and 61 to 64 on NBC.
Oh, wow. Now,
and then it went into reruns. But then we did George of the Jungle later in 67.
Right, George of the Jungle, and they had, I remember that, the Super Chicken and all that, yeah.
Right, and right. Tom Slick.
Tom Slick, oh yeah, yeah. Now, yeah. I have to ask you this, June, because I really don't know how it works, so I'm asking you just because I'm sure there's other people that wonder this, too. When you would go into the studios for, say, Rocky and Bullwinkle, or for any of those shows, was it more or less, June, just read this, this, and this, and be on your way? Or did you get a chance to get a feel for the characters before you started?
No. You go to they hired proficient people who could, most of them at first came from radio. You pick up a script, you read it, and you do it. And that's what we did. Okay. And Chuck Jones was wonderful that way. 'Cause everything Chuck did, I did. And when he went to MGM, of course, I did Tom and Jerry's for him. But also, we'd record, say, one voice, and I'd say, well, wouldn't you like to take another take for protection? No, that was fine. They directed their own, Fritz Freeling and Chuck and Bob McKinson, and they... Walter Lance was wonderful, and he was always there, and they never gave directions to us. They'd give us the script, we'd read it through, do it, and go home.
Wow, isn't that something? That's great.
Yeah.
That's wild. Now, did you have any really, were there any fun stories that went on during the Bullwinkle recordings, or was it just pretty much business as usual when you went in?
Oh, no, we always told jokes. Bill Conrad and Paul Frees, They knew each other from radio. I had never worked with either one of them, but I had known about them. And they would come in and they'd harangue each other and tell jokes and laugh. And and finally, Jay would say, okay, let's do it. Yeah. But it was like going to a party every night.
That's something else. That must have been
it
a
was
great
fun.
Time.
Yep. Fun.
Now, this is another thing that's kind of funny, too. I noticed a lot in the entertainment industry where there's people, the content creators, actors, actresses, some of them, now this is kind of split down the middle, I've noticed, some of them resent being remembered for a particular role in their career. Then there's others that embrace it and say, you know what, if that was my best role, that's what everybody remembers, great. Do you have any issues with being associated with Rocky Squirrel, or are you totally thrilled?
No,
with
I love everything I've done.
Yeah,
I'm proud
great.
Of it. And I get fan mail from all over the world. I get fan mail from Singapore, from Finland, from India, and
that's
all
right.
over Europe. It's incredible. See, they used to redub them into their own language. But now most of the people in various countries speak English.
Right.
And so they hear the original now, and they know it's I.
That's got to make you feel good, though. That's great.
It's very heartwarming. You know, I've just done what I wanted to do, and I was capable of doing. I never expected anything like this.
Now, I was curious to know if you remember some of the characters you did for the old Rankin Bass specials. I used to love those.
You know, I know that I did them, but I can't remember the characters.
It's fine.
I did so many, Todd, that it's difficult for me to remember.
Oh, I understand. I just threw that one out there because I thought, oh, God, those were great. I used to love watching those as a kid. I still like watching those, you know. I guess we never grow up, but... Now, what were the attitudes toward voice actors, though, particularly back then when you were starting out, and has it changed at all in today's climate?
Oh, well, they know how important animation is. I was on the Board of Governors of the Motion Picture Academy, as you probably know, for 26 years. And at first, we tried to get an Oscar for the animated features, and they thought, oh, well, you know, what is animation, you know, compared to Gone with the Wind or something like that. But we got it about 10 years ago, and Jeffrey Katzenberg called me and thanked me because he won the first one for Shrek. So, you know, now animation is so important that they're hiring stars to do the voices, and they're taking jobs away from some of the best actors, the voice actors.
See, you made a perfect segue to another question I had down the road, and I'll bring that up because I know this is strange. But back in the late 90s, I remember reading an animation magazine where a lot of the voice talent, such as yourself, but there was a lot of those people were kind of a little bit upset. They're saying, you know, they didn't like the shift that was going on in Hollywood where they were just bringing in big name actors and actresses to do the voices just to bring the numbers up, you know, the dollars in, as opposed to, you know, do you feel is that still a lot of, is there still a lot of resentment there going on?
Well, I think there is I don't mind. I'm still working, but, and I have enough security. However, there are a lot of voice people who are not doing pictures. I know the last picture I did was Grandma Fa in Mulan, and she was quite a hit. But now they say a picture starring Angelina Jolie or Tom Hanks or whatever, and they think that's going to sell. And they're paying them a lot of money that they never paid the voice people.
Yeah, that's got to hurt. Yeah, that's got to be
painful. It's painful for the young people who've been working the voiceovers, you know.
You know, and I'll have to admit, I really see the value in good voice talent. It is so incredibly important because I have seen... And I won't name any names, but I've seen a few cartoons in the last 10 years that have fallen flat on their face because, personally, I thought the artwork was great. I thought the story was fine, but they were miscast. The voices were wrong, and to me, it killed it. And I thought, well, maybe that's just me, and maybe I'm just very picky. And then about a year later, it's off the air. So obviously, there's something to it, you know?
A lot of people feel that way.
Yeah, and it's
what do the kids care?
Right.
The kids don't give a tinker's dime about it. You know.
Yeah. It's really something.
It's
so important to have the right voice, I think, you know.
That's true.
Now, I think there's a lot of people that don't realize you had a lead movie role, and hopefully I'm not going to kill the name of the movie. Sabaka?
Oh, yeah.
Was that a lot of fun to do?
Oh, it was fun, but I thought it was a horrible movie.
Okay.
Did you see it?
I'll be honest with you, June, I have not seen it. I have not seen it.
But... Well, anyway, I hadn't seen it for years until somebody sent me a DVD of it.
Oh,
I did a good acting job of it, I thought.
Did you enjoy, you were also in, you had some roles, cameo roles in Boris and Natasha, and I think The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle, you know, the CGI movie.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Those had to be pretty fun to do.
Yeah. I've had a wonderful life, and it's still going on.
Yeah. That's what's great. That's now, very, how does it feel to have an award named after you? Because there's the June Foray Award, which it goes
well,
to individuals.
It's very flattering because I started ASIFA Hollywood, and I started the Annie Awards when I was president. And so we gave it to all the wonderful people, and I started the Windsor McKay Award. And for a while, we were just giving it to men, and I thought, you know, there must be women in animation who deserve an Annie Award. And I was only a kid when you heard of Popeye. And so I thought, gee whiz, why don't I get Mae Questel, who did Popeye, and she did Olive Oil and Betty Boop. And she was one of the first women that you ever heard of in animation. And I didn't know anybody who knew her. Finally, somebody told me that she lived in New York and gave me her phone number. And I called her, and we gave her an Annie Award. And she stayed at my house. Charming, charming lady who had a lot of energy and comedy, and she was wonderful.
Wow, that's a great story, man. Yep, that sounds great. Yeah, those were some great, great cartoons back then. Great stuff.
Yes, yeah, they were.
Was there ever a role, an acting role, that you turned down that you regretted later or just didn't feel comfortable doing? Do you remember any roles that were...
No, I took them all. Took them all.
Okay, now there's some people that may not realize you recently authored an autobiography called Did You Grow Up With Me Too? How's that book coming along? How did that start, and is it doing pretty well?
I wrote a lot of it, and then Mark Evanier and Earl Kress are writers, and they expanded on it a lot, you know, made it cozier and friendlier, maybe, I don't know. I brought it to the, they printed 300 for the Comic-Con down in San Diego. And I personally autographed 250 books that were sold. And, but there are a lot of grammatical errors that kind of embarrass me. Like I can't understand why a writer would say shorter than me instead of shorter than I. That was the most glaring one. The others were, you know, tiny little grammatical errors, but they said they'd send their correction. And so the next printing, which will be a much bigger printing, they'll have all the corrections.
Well, I will be buying one, just so you know.
Well, it's an interesting story. It really is. But there are things that I would like to have put in, which I didn't, because they were in a hurry to get it to the Comic-Con. And so I'm going to start a new book called Postscript, Remembering Things I Forgot to Remember.
Oh, that'd be great. That's great.
And so I've got a lot of things in there that are amusing and funny and, you know.
Yeah. Now, you're still working today, and so what projects are you involved with right now?
I beg your pardon?
What projects are you currently involved with right now?
Well, I just did a couple of Flapjacks. I haven't even seen them yet. I just did a couple of Flapjacks, and I did three more Looney Tunes as Granny.
Yeah. Which, by the way, I think that's just such an iconic voice. Just an you know, I told my wife about it. She said, well, because she doesn't really watch a lot of cartoons. I said, well, she was asking about you. And I said, okay, what about Granny? I'm from Tweety and Sylvester. Oh, yeah, I know Granny. So
Yeah, everybody loves Granny.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Right.
That's great. That's great. And I noticed there was a photograph of you that had the Rocky's J. Squirrel pendant around your neck.
Yes, I do. Yeah.
Yes.
My niece, who sculpted E.T. In the movie E.T., she sculpted it. And she said, what do I get my aunt for Christmas? So she sculpted a Rocky, a solid gold Rocky. And I just never take it off. It's wonderful. And every time I'm interviewed, they the camera goes down and centers on Rocky.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
It did. It looked very nice. It was very pretty. It was really nice.
Yeah.
Well, it looks like I covered everything. Now, can you still do the Rocky Squirrel voice? You still do that on occasion on your own time?
I sure can.
Yeah, you sure can? Because I was going to, the one I really wanted to hear is, and now here's something we hope you'll really like. You know, that's.
And now here's something I hope you really like.
That's fantastic. June, it's been a pleasure, June. Thank you so much for
talking to me. Thank you. And it's nice of you to call and talk to me.
It was wonderful. Thank you again.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Have a nice day.
Okay. You too.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thanks. Bye.
Well, that concluded another podcast, another Boing podcast. Hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. June Foray was a wonderful, wonderful guest. And I just love listening to her stories. It's just amazing. And the history that's behind it is just incredible. Well, there's not much going on. Next podcast, we'll have hopefully another good guest. And I'm going to see if I can get some comic strip people coming up in the next few months. And we'll keep on plugging along. And I appreciate you guys listening. I hear the music starting to chime in. And maybe we'll have some more animation news and other things to share in the next podcast. I'll try to mix it up a little bit. Hopefully you guys are enjoying this stuff. So I certainly enjoy putting it together for you. And as I work on my own children's book right now, I'm just learning so much from these wonderful guests that have great in-depth experience. And it's just so much wisdom to share with people that are, you know, doing this for the first time or just haven't quite found their niche yet, you know. Basically, from what I've gathered from these interviews, it's just a matter of to keep on plugging along and for every setback you have, let it be a lesson and keep on, you know, moving forward. And who knows where it will lead. So it's been a work of passion for me, and it's really been more like pleasure for me. So thanks again for listening. I hear the music starting to chime in. Gotta go. Take care, everybody. So long. And Dad, if you're out there, this one's for you.